In the dawn, Ramon swam down to the head of the bay and then made the hard 2-mile return against the tide, ploughing in a crawl through the choppy water. And when he came up from the beach, Nicholas was ready for school, and there was an army jeep and driver waiting at the back door of the cottage. Ramon was dressed in plain brown paratrooper fatigues and soft cap. This was revolutionary uniform, so different from the flamboyant Russian braid and scarlet piping and tiers of medal ribbons. Nicholas sat proudly beside him in the jeep for the short ride until they dropped him off at the nursery school near the main gate. The drive up to Havana took a little over 2 hours, for the sugar harvest was in progress. The sky over the hills was smudged with smoke from the cane fires, and the road was congested with behemoth trucks piled high with cargoes of cut cane en route to the mills. When they reached the city, the driver dropped Ramon at the far end of the vast Plaza de la Revolución, with its 350-foot obelisk to the memory of José Martí, hero of the people, who founded the Cuban Revolutionary Party way back in 1892. The square was the scene of many of the moving rallies of the party, where a million and more of the Cuban people gathered to listen to Fidel Castro's speeches. The president's office was in the building of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba, of which El Jefe was the first secretary. The office in which he welcomed Ramon was as austere as the revolutionary principle dictated. Under the revolving ceiling fan, the massive desk was piled with working documents and reports. However, the white walls were bare of all ornament, except for the portrait of Lenin on the wall behind his desk. Fidel Castro came to embrace Ramon. "Mis oro dorado," he chuckled with pleasure. "My golden fox. It is good to see you. You've been away too long, old comrade, much too long." "It is good to be back, El Jefe," Ramon truly meant it. Here was one man he respected and loved above all others. He was always startled by the size of the man he called the leader. Castro towered over him and smothered Ramon in his embrace. Then he held him at arm's length and studied his face. "You look tired, comrade. You have been working hard?" "With excellent results," Ramon assured him. "Come, sit down by the window," Castro invited him. "Tell me about it." He selected 2 cigars from the box on the corner of his desk and gave one to Ramon. He held the burning taper for him, then lit his own before he settled into the straight-backed chair and leant forward with the cigar stuck out of the corner of his mouth, puffing smoke around it. "So tell me, what is the news from Moscow? You saw Yudenich?"
"I saw him, El Jefe. And the meeting went well," Ramon launched into his report. It was typical of them that there was no small talk, no preamble to serious discussions. Neither of them had to manoeuvre for position or advantage. Ramon could speak with total honesty, without worrying about giving offence or trying to improve his own position. His position was unassailable. They were brothers of the blood and of the soul. Of course, Castro could be changeable. His affections could shift. It had been that way with Che Guevara, another of the 82 heroes who came ashore from Granma. Che had fallen from grace after he had disagreed with Castro's economic policies, and he had been driven out to become a wandering knight of the revolution, a Walt Whitman with grenade and AK-47. Yes, it had happened to Che, but it could never happen to Ramon. "Yudenich has agreed to back our new export drive," Ramon told him, and Castro chuckled. It was a little joke between them. Castro was an inspired political genius, and that rare gift of being able to communicate his passionate vision to the masses of the people. However, although he was an educated man, a qualified lawyer who had practiced his profession before the revolution had swept him up, he was no economist. His grasp of the whole arcane science of economics was weak. He could not bother himself with the balance of payments and employment and productivity. His vision was sweeping and transcended those petty aspects of the body politic. He liked the bold and the big. Ramon had conceived the entire plan to appeal to El Jefe. It was bold and it was direct. The problem was that Cuba's island wealth was based on 3 staples, sugar and tobacco and coffee. These were insufficient to provide the hard currency to fuel Castro's ambitious plans for urban renewal and social welfare, let alone to provide full employment for an exploding population. Since the revolution, the population had doubled. According to the forecasts, it would double again in the next 10 years. Ramon's plan had been devised to counter these problems. It would provide hard cash and go far to ending unemployment on the island. The new export drive was simply the export of men, of fighting men and women. They would be sent out in their tens of thousands as mercenaries to pursue the revolution at the ends of the earth. Perhaps as many as 100,000. Nearly 10% of the island's total workforce could be exported. At one stroke, they would end unemployment and swell the public coffer with the fees of a mercenary army. Castro had liked the plan from the first day that Ramon had propounded it to him. It was the kind of economics that he could understand and applaud. Yudenich will recommend it to Brezhnev, Ramon assured him. And Castro stroked his beard as though it were a shaggy black cat. Well, if Yudenich recommends it, then we have no worries. He leant forward with his hands on his knees. And we both know where you want them sent. I have meetings this afternoon at the Tanzanian embassy, Ramon said. There were 17 African embassies in Havana, all of them representatives of socialist governments newly liberated from colonial oppression. Tanzania, under Julius Nyerere, was amongst the most Marxist of them all. Already Nyerere had declared that any person who owned more than 1 acre of property was a capitalist and enemy of the people, and that they would be punished by having all their property confiscated by the state. The Tanzanians were active in their support for those others struggling for liberation in the colonial slave states in the rest of Africa. They provided shelter for the freedom fighters from Portuguese Angola and Mozambique, from the racist pariah South Africa, and from the medieval serfdom of the ancient tyrant Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. In all those countries, there would be work for the army of Cuban mercenaries. I am meeting officers of the Ethiopian army who are dedicated to the cause of Marxist socialism and who are prepared to risk their lives to break the yoke of the oppressor.
Yes, Castro nodded. Ethiopia is ripe for us.
Ramon considered the ash of his cigar. It was firm and crisp, almost 2 inches long. We both know that destiny has dictated that you play a role beyond the shores of this lovely island. Africa awaits you. Castro leant back with satisfaction and placed his huge, powerful hands on his knees as Ramon went on. The Africans have a natural distrust of Mother Russia. The Russians in the Kremlin are all Caucasians. The word originates in that country. It is an unfortunate fact that despite all their other virtues, most Russians are racists. We cannot escape that fact. Many of the African leaders, especially the young ones, have studied in Russia. They have heard the name Obozyana, monkey, whispered as they pass in the corridors of Patrice Lumumba University. The Russians are white men and racists. Deep in his heart, the African does not trust them. Ramon drew evenly on his cigar, and they were silent a while. Castro broke the silence.
Go on. On the other hand, you, El Jefe, are a great-grandson of Africa.
But Castro shook his head.
I am Spanish, he contradicted.
Ramon smiled and went on. If you were to claim that your forefathers were sold on the slave block in Havana, who would doubt it? He suggested delicately. And how vast might your influence become in Africa? Castro was silent, contemplating that vision, and Ramon went on softly. We must arrange a tour for you. A triumphant cavalcade beginning in Egypt and going southwards through 20 nations in which you could declare your concern, your commitment to the African people. If you could demonstrate your Africanism to 200 million Africans, how great might your influence become? Ramon leant forward and touched his wrist.
No longer the president of a tiny beleaguered island. No longer the plaything of America. But a statesman of world influence and power.
My golden fox, Castro said softly.
No wonder that I love you.
The Tanzanian embassy was temporarily accommodated in one of the Spanish colonial buildings in the old city. There the Ethiopians were waiting for Ramon. There were 3 of them, all young officers in the imperial army of Emperor Haile Selassie. Only 1 of the 3 interested Ramon Machado. He had met Captain Getachew Ebebe on several previous visits to Addis Ababa. In Ethiopia, ethnic lines cannot be distinguished. 1,000 years of invasion and interbreeding between Caucasian tribes from across the Red Sea and those from the heartland of the African continent have resulted in a mélange that cannot be separated. Definitions such as Gala and Amhara refer to linguistic and cultural groupings rather than to bloodlines. However, in Captain Getachew Ebebe, the pure African ancestral influence dominated. He was very dark-skinned, with full lips and pockmarked skin. He was a product of the University of Addis Ababa. Joe Cicero had succeeded in infiltrating a strong cadre of American and British Marxists into the university in the roles of professors and lecturers. As one of their star students, Getachew Ebebe had been transformed into a dedicated Marxist-Leninist. Ramon had studied and courted him over the years until now he judged that he was the right man. At the very least, he was intelligent, hard and ruthless, and totally committed to the cause. Although he was only in his middle 30s, he was Ramon's provisional choice for the next leader of Ethiopia. As they shook hands in the shuttered sitting room at the back of the Tanzanian embassy, Ramon cautioned him with a glance and a small gesture towards the collection of African tribal masks that covered the walls. Any one of these could conceal a microphone. The conversation that followed was trivial and inconclusive and lasted less than half an hour. As they shook hands, Ramon leant close to Ebebe and whispered four words, a place and a time. The two of them met again an hour later in the Bodeguita del Medio. It was the most famous bar in the old city. There was sawdust on the floor, and the tables and chairs were scarred and battered. The walls were pitted and scratched with the graffiti and signatures of the famous and the ordinary, from Hemingway to Spencer Tracy and Edward, Duke of Windsor. They had all drunk here. Their faded, yellowed photographs were tacked into plain wooden frames that hung fly-spotted and askew upon the grubby walls. The long, narrow room was thick with smoke, the cacophony of a portable radio blaring Bembe folk music, and the shouted, tiddly conversation of the customers covered their own quiet discussion. They sat in the furthest corner, with a mojito on the table in front of each of them. The condensation ran down the glasses and formed wet rings on the wood, but neither of them touched the drinks. "Comrade, the time is almost ripe," Ramon said, and Ebebe nodded. "The Lion of Amhara has grown old and toothless. His son is a weak, indulgent idiot. The nation groans under his tyranny and hungers in the worst famine and drought for 100 years. The time is ripe." "There are two things we must avoid," Ramon cautioned. "The first is an armed revolution. If the army rises and executes the emperor immediately, you will be passed over. You are still too junior in rank. One of the generals will seize power." "So?" Ebebe asked. "What is the solution?" "A creeping revolution," Ramon told him, and it was the first time Ebebe had ever heard the term used, though he would not admit it. "I see," he murmured. And Ramon went on to enlighten him. The Derg must call Haile Selassie to account and demand his abdication. As you say, the old lion has lost his teeth. He is isolated and out of touch. He must comply. You will use all your influence in the Derg, and I will exert all of mine.